Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
When did you confess to your crush only for you to find out they were someone you once rejected? Story 1. Back in high school, a girl named Claire had a crush on me. She confessed one afternoon in the library, stammering out that she liked me. I panicked and brushed her off with a vague excuse about being too focused on school. Truth was, I was immature and thought dating her would make me look uncool. Fast forward 6 years, we ended up in the same grad program. She looked different, more confident, stylish, surrounded by people who genuinely admired her. Somewhere in the middle of our group project, I realized I liked her. I tried to confess, half expecting a warm laugh about the past. She listened, then smiled with a calmness that hit me like a train. "You know, I told you how I felt once. You rejected me. I moved on." She was dating someone in our program, someone she said treated her with kindness from day one. I walked home that night, replaying my smug 16-year-old self, realizing I'd fumbled something I could never get back. Story 2. In college, I confessed to a girl from my English lit seminar. I'd been watching her for weeks, noticing the way she annotated books, like she was solving a puzzle. I invited her to coffee, stumbled through my feelings, and braced for rejection. Instead, she laughed, not mockingly, but with genuine surprise. "Do you even remember rejecting me 2 years ago?" she asked. I blinked, completely lost. Turns out, in freshman year, she had asked me to a campus concert. I'd casually said I wasn't interested in something serious and walked off. To me, it was just another forgettable moment. To her, it was enough to never try again. Now, here I was confessing, and she reminded me she had already moved on. She wasn't bitter, just detached, like that version of her didn't exist anymore. That stung more than if she'd mocked me, because I realized she'd genuinely stopped seeing me as an option long ago. Story 3. I once confessed to my coworker after months of late-night shifts together. We had inside jokes, shared playlists, and moments where I thought sparks were undeniable. One Friday, I finally blurted out, "I like you, more than a friend." She tilted her head, smiled sympathetically, and said, "That's funny, because I used to like you." I even hinted at it a year ago when we both covered Christmas Eve. My memory flashed back. She'd asked if I wanted to grab dinner after work that night. I'd brushed it off, saying I already had plans with friends. Truth was, I didn't want to complicate work. She admitted she tried for weeks after, then gave up when I didn't notice. Now she was dating someone else. I had to sit across from her every day, realizing I'd closed the door before I even knew it was open. The irony still makes me wince whenever someone mentions missed chances. Story 4. There was this girl from my hometown, Julia. She was always sweet on me, and one summer before college, she confessed. I was young, restless, and thought I was outgrowing small-town girls, so I let her down, clumsily, maybe even condescendingly. Years later, at a friend's wedding, I spotted her again. She had grown into herself in ways I never could have imagined. Confident, magnetic, with a laugh that made the whole room look her way. After a few drinks, I confessed I always liked her but had been stupid back then. She looked me straight in the eyes and said, "Funny, I once said those exact words to you." Her fiancé came up and slid an arm around her waist before I could even respond. I clapped him on the shoulder, congratulated them, and excused myself. Nothing dramatic happened, but the ache lingered for weeks. That was the first time I really understood regret in my bones. Story 5. This one still twists me inside. I confessed to a girl in my friend group during our senior year of college. She was the kind of person who filled silence with easy laughter, who somehow remembered everyone's favorite coffee order. I worked up the courage during finals, thinking the timing was perfect since we'd all be splitting after graduation. I told her I had feelings. She froze, then gave me this bittersweet look. "Do you remember sophomore year at that party?" she asked. Vaguely, I recalled her sitting next to me, tipsy but earnest, saying she liked me. And me, half drunk, half arrogant, telling her she was like a sister, and that I didn't want to ruin the group dynamic. She reminded me of that night word for word. She wasn't cruel, but she said gently, "I gave you that chance once. I can't go back there now." It wasn't rejection. It was closure. And closure can sting worse than a flat-out no. Story 6. Back in middle school, I was that awkward kid who thought girls were nothing but distractions. One day, a quiet girl named Erin slipped me a note during class. It was the classic, "Do you like me? Yes or no?" with boxes. I chuckled, scribbled "no," and passed it back. She turned red and I didn't think much of it. Fast forward a decade, I moved back to my hometown and ran into her at a community volunteering event. She was different. Self-assured, witty, beautiful in a way that made me stumble. We got to talking and I realized how much I wanted to know her better. I confessed one evening, my voice shaking. She listened patiently, then laughed softly. "You know, I once put myself out there for you. You crushed me with a single check mark." She wasn't bitter, just matter of fact. Erin told me she was happily engaged. I congratulated her, all while feeling like my 13-year-old self had set a trap I fell into years later. Story 7. During my second year at university, I joined the debate team. There was a guy named Marcus, who everyone thought was arrogant, but I found his sharp wit magnetic. After months of spending time together, I confessed in a nervous blur. He stared at me for a long moment before grinning. "That's ironic," he said. "Remember our first year mixer? I tried flirting with you the entire night. You told me you weren't into cocky types and walked away." I barely remembered the incident, but he did. He explained that my dismissal back then taught him to guard himself. Now he was dating someone outside the team. The worst part? I could see how genuinely happy they were together. It wasn't about losing to another person, it was realizing my younger self's snap judgment had closed a door before I even knew I'd want to walk through it. Story 8. In high school, I turned down a girl named Leah who invited me to homecoming. At the time, I thought she wasn't my type. I remember using that exact phrase. Years later, after college, we both ended up at the same company. We started collaborating on projects, and I was floored by her intelligence and charm. Gradually, I started falling for her. I asked her out, half expecting her to say yes since our chemistry at work was undeniable. She chuckled and said, "You know, you're consistent. Still not into your type, I guess." She reminded me of the homecoming rejection, how she stood there in a new dress and got turned down. Now she was with someone else, and she told me gently that her heart had healed a long time ago. Standing in that office, hearing her laugh about something that once made her cry, I realized timing can make or break everything. Story 9. Back in freshman year of college, a girl in my dorm named Dana asked me out. She was shy and artsy, always sketching in the lounge. I politely declined, telling her I wasn't looking for a relationship. In truth, I just didn't think much of it at the time. Years later, after we lost touch, I found myself at an art exhibition in the city. Guess whose work was displayed? Dana's. She was radiant, commanding a crowd, her art selling like crazy. We reconnected, and sparks flew immediately, at least for me. After a few meetups, I confessed. She smiled kindly but said, "I asked you once. I'm not asking you again." She told me she valued what we had now as acquaintances, but she'd closed that romantic chapter long ago. I stood in that gallery, surrounded by her talent, and realized I'd rejected not just a person, but a whole future version of them I never imagined. Story 10. When I was 17, I worked at a fast food place. There was a guy named Sam who always covered shifts with me. One night after closing, he admitted he liked me. I laughed nervously and brushed it off, saying I wasn't interested. Truth was, I was scared of what people would think. Years later, after college, we ended up reconnecting through mutual friends. He'd grown into himself, confident and charismatic, and my feelings hit me all at once. At a friend's bonfire, I finally confessed. He listened quietly before saying, "I gave you the first chance, remember? You didn't want it." He wasn't cruel, but his words cut deep. He told me he was happy now with his boyfriend, someone who never hesitated to accept him. I congratulated him, feeling both proud and hollow. The irony was almost poetic. I had once dismissed him out of fear, and now I was the one left behind. Story 11. In 2016, I joined a language exchange app because I liked the idea of practicing Spanish with real people. My partner was Elle. She'd send voice notes of Madrid traffic and little critiques of my accent that somehow never felt harsh. After a month, she asked if I wanted to switch to video and maybe meet when...
Remember those endless summer days that felt like they just last forever? Sun rays kiss your skin, grass tickles your toes as you bite into the creamy popsicle melting in your hand. Pure, unbothered bliss. Capture more sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. This nostalgic vanilla flavor with notes of candied orange can help keep you hydrated while savoring your favorite golden hour moments. No matter how hot your summer gets, just one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than water alone. It's three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, with 8 vitamins and nutrients for refreshing on-the-go hydration. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. That's code INDULGE20 at liquidiv.com.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
She visited New York. I dodged with a polite wall of excuses, work, classes, a busy season. Truth, I was insecure and figured online connections didn't count. We drifted. I forgot. 3 years later, my company sent me to a Barcelona tech conference. The keynote used live interpretation. The interpreter's voice was familiar in a way that held on, warm and precise, turning clunky jargon into music. Afterward, at a tapas place crowded with post-panel egos, I met her in person, Lucia, poised, funny, devastatingly present. We traded stories until late. I confessed I'd been captivated all day and asked if she'd go out with me while I was in town. She tilted her head, the smallest smile. "You're very confident. It's nice," she said. "But we actually talked before." When she said the username, my stomach fell through the table. She pulled up a screenshot of my old message. "Hey, sorry. Can't do video. Busy, nothing cruel. Just dismissive in that way that tells a person they aren't worth rearranging a single hour." "I liked you then," she said, not unkindly. "Enough to risk being awkward." That was my confession. She wasn't angry. She'd simply lived more life since, and there was a ring on her hand I hadn't noticed. Simple gold catching the bar light. We finished our drinks, trading travel tips like strangers on a train. Walking back to the hotel, I played her voice in my head, how I once had it on my phone for free and treated it like background noise. Funny how fluency comes last to the one language you most needed to learn. Timing. Story 12. I started climbing because my therapist said I needed a hobby where falling was safe. The gym smelled like chalk and second chances. I kept noticing a woman named Bree, calm, technical, the kind of climber who floats instead of fights. One Saturday, she offered to belay me on a route everyone called the meter maid. Midway up, I panicked. She talked me through it, patient and precise. When I stuck the top, something in my chest clicked. After a month of shared ropes and post-session smoothies, I told her I liked her. My voice actually shook. She looked down at our knot like it might answer for us both. "That's kind," she said, "and awkward."
"Awkward?"
Bree pulled out her phone and scrolled with the casualness of someone unlocking a vault. A text thread from last year appeared, her inviting me to an outdoor trip. Belay, picnic, meteor shower. My reply was a paragraph that read like a liability waiver. "Gym crushes are messy, safety first. I don't date climbers." I remembered crafting it, convinced I was being principled when really I was being patronizing. "I took that as a no," she said, gentle, "and I moved on. Met someone at that same crag a month later." She smiled at something invisible past my shoulder, a memory shaped like a campfire. We climbed another route and I climbed it badly. On the last move, I peeled, rope catching clean. I hung there like a punctuation mark at the end of my own lecture. Back on the ground, I apologized for what? Being late? Being slow? Being a year too late? Bree shrugged, kind as always. "Belay's on," she said. "Crushes come and go. Good partners are rare. I still climb. I still think about how a knot has two ends mirroring each other, how you can tie it correctly and still be on the wrong side of the timing." Story 13. At 25, I was the kind of product manager who treated happy hours like press conferences. At a startup mixer, a founder named Priya pitched me an idea about mutual aid logistics, neighbor-to-neighbor micro-deliveries. I loved it and said so. We talked for an hour. As the crowd thinned, she asked if I wanted to grab coffee sometime. For founder gossip and maybe something not entirely professional. I launched into a speech about boundaries and how I didn't date in ecosystem. It sounded noble in my head and smug out loud. We traded LinkedIns and drifted. 2 years later, my company imploded. I freelanced, humbled. A friend invited me to demo day at an accelerator. The star of the night was a logistics startup mapping community capacity in real time. The founder, Priya, stage ready now, dangerous with clarity. Her team won everything, press, checks, the standing ovation that shakes the floorboards. We ran into each other at the after party. She remembered me, worse, remembered my speech. I told her I'd been following her progress, that I admired her, and then I said the thing I hadn't said before. "I like you." Outside of pitch decks and policies, she held my gaze the way you hold a plank, steady and patient. "I once told you that," she said, "and you turned it into a TED talk." There was no heat in it, only accuracy. She lifted her glass toward a cluster of her team, where a tall woman was laughing with a ribbon around her wrist, one of those event bracelets that looks suspiciously like a promise. "I'm seeing someone," she added, softening. "We met building night shift routes last winter. We talked shop another 10 minutes. I walked home with the familiar taste of metal in my mouth, that penny-flavored mix of pride and regret. If timing is everything, then grandstanding is the opposite. All crescendo. No entrance cue. Story 14. Back in 2014, I played an MMO every night with a guild called Night Orchard. My healer was Rivenfox, ruthless in raids and shy in DMs. One late winter night, she typed a message that felt like stepping onto thin ice. She liked me, not just my DPS. I panicked, threw up a joke about not confusing pixels with people, and added a moral about focusing on the grind. She left the guild a week later. I told myself she'd burned out. Last year, I went to a comic con with a friend who makes armor out of foam mats. At a booth selling enamel pins shaped like potions, I bumped into a cosplayer in hand-stitched leather and clever foxtail details. We ended up in line for noodles, talking until the convention lights hummed off. Her name was Erin. Her laugh felt like a checkpoint. When she touched my wrist to make a point, my brain wrote 10 futures all at once. I asked if she'd like to get dinner after the Saturday panels. She tilted her head. "Do you still believe people online aren't real?" The world stuttered. She told me her old handle, and I swear I heard the guild chat ding. Rivenfox. She described the raid where I'd made that crack, the way it emptied the room behind her monitor. Then she showed me a photo strip. her and a woman I'd seen at the artist alley. Foreheads touching, ink still shiny from the booth printer. "I met her in that guild you told me to grow up and leave," Aaron said, smiling like the end of a quest. She whispered me after I logged off crying. We still walked the floor together Sunday, pointing at art, admiring craft. "I bought a potion pin, blue for mana, for what you spend to keep others alive. I think about it when friends call online, love fake, how you can be healed by hands you never see and still hurt them with a sentence." Story 15. During the pandemic, I worked nights delivering groceries for a local co-op. There was a driver who always beat me to the best parking spots and left chalk hearts on the warehouse floor near the sanitizer. Her name tag said Jay. Once, after a brutal shift, my windshield wore a note in neat block letters. "Your playlists make the loading dock bearable. Coffee sometime? Jay." I took a picture for our group chat, made a teasing joke about mystery admirers, and never answered. The next week, Jay wasn't on the schedule. I assumed she'd found a better job. 2 years later, when floods hit a nearby town, I signed up for the volunteer crew hauling debris. Our site coordinator, Jamie, ran the chaos like a symphony. Gloves, tarps, a whistle that ended arguments. By day three, we knew each other's sandwich orders. By day five, the mud had settled into a shared language. At sunset, leaning against a ruined fence, I told her the truth. I was starting to like her, not just her competence. She eyed my car, then me. "You used to drive a silver hatchback, right? Stickers on the bumper about biking and bad coffee." I laughed. "Yeah." She reached into her pocket and unfolded a photo of a note. The note creased along the same lines I once ignored. "I kept the picture," she said. "I was proud of myself for asking." All the noise of generators and crowbars thinned. I apologized. It sounded small. Jamie shook her head. "I'm not mad," I asked. "You answered, just not to me." She glanced toward the supply tent where a woman in a yellow hard hat waved. The wave she returned had a softness to it, a homeward direction. We finished the week. On the last day, she pressed a spare whistle into my palm. "You're good at moving heavy things," she said. "Just don't be so quick to drop the light ones." On the drive back, the highway lifted out of the floodplain and the sky went stubbornly blue. Somewhere under the seat, a curl of chalk dust glowed like proof I'd been seen and decided against, years before I knew I wanted to be found. Story 16. Sophomore year, our English teacher ran an anonymous pen pal project. My match called themselves Pinecone. Their letters were dorky. Pressed leaves, bad puns, stories about a grandparent's garden that made me feel like summer in January. The last envelope carried a confession written in tiny, brave script. They liked me. I wrote back a clean refusal, textbook polite. "I value the friendship, but don't want to blur lines." I told myself I was being mature. We handed our final letters to the teacher. The project ended. I never learned who Pinecone was. 5 years later, I started going to a tiny poetry open mic because the espresso tasted like forgiveness, and a reader named Noah shook the room without raising their voice. No drama, just truth arranged to catch the light. After 3 Thursdays of ordering courage in ceramic cups, I asked if they wanted to grab dinner. I said it messy. "I like you. I'm nervous." "That's a good sign." Noah's smile was kind, but slanted. "Can I show you something?" They slid a photo from their wallet. A letter with my handwriting. The exact phrases I'd used to decline Pinecone. In the corner, a teacher's stamp. "Received." "I kept it," Noah said. "Not as a wound, more like a postcard from a place I had to pass through." They told me they'd been scared then. How pressing that leaf had felt like sending a part of their body. I wanted to say I'd changed, that lines can blur into roads, that we could try again. Noah folded the photo, steady hands doing something gentle and final. "I'm seeing someone. They also collect leaves." The mic list moved on without us. We still talked about craft and the way rhymes hide in city noise. When the barista wiped our table, a dusting of grounds smelled like rain. On the walk home, it hit me that my neat refusal had aged like a stamp, still sticky where it mattered. Story 17. In kitchens, you learn to triage. Hot things first, then everything else. I was Sue at a neighborhood bistro the year we landed a pastry chef named Ray. She moved like a metronome, no wasted motion, sugar obeying her. The first time I tasted her grapefruit tart, I swear I heard a choir made of brulee torches. After months of service, staff meal, and the kind of eye contact people make over rapidly melting ice cream, I told her I liked her. "I know the rule against kitchen romances," I said, "but I also know the rule about salt. Some rules exist to make flavor." Ray wiped her hands on a towel, folded it once, twice. "Do you remember the corner cafe on Cedar?" she asked. "2 years ago, a barista invited you to a gallery opening after you camped at a table writing prep lists. You told her you don't date service workers because you need boundaries." I remembered the cafe. I remembered my own voice, leather apron, and borrowed authority, the way I said boundaries like I'd invented them. The barista's laugh had curled in on itself. "That was me," Ray said. "I went anyway, met someone by the exit sign." She glanced toward the dining room where our new GM was wiping a wine glass with worshipful precision. Ray's face softened. "You're good at your job," she added. "But I did my confessing already. I learned to plate my heart differently after." That night, the ticket machine chewed out orders with vindictive speed. I sliced my thumb open on a stubborn lemon and didn't tell anyone, pressing a towel into the cut like an apology. Service ended. Ray left a ramekin at my station, custard set just right, a pinch of salt on top. On the plastic wrap, she'd written, "For the scar." It tasted like forgiveness. It stayed on my tongue the whole ugly walk home. Story 18. Our neighborhood turned a vacant lot into a community garden. I signed up because my apartment's only plant was a basil bush determined to die on principle. The organizer, Mina, had a clipboard and a laugh that made people bring extra seeds. She taught me compost like it was alchemy and let me name a feral cat Compostella. Dirt under our nails, sun in our teeth. By the second Saturday, I was practicing a confession while pretending to stake tomatoes. When I finally said it, she leaned on the fence post, listening like a good clinician. "Thank you," she said, which felt like both yes and no. Then she pulled a folded receipt from her pocket. Water-stained, but readable. "Do you remember this? It was from my building 2 years ago, a delivery for a sloppy Friday night. On the back, someone had scrawled, 'Your playlist made my route. Coffee sometime?'" I'd written, "Not looking," in Sharpie, and slipped it back with the tip, proud of my clear communication. "I was doing gig work then," Mina said. "I felt ridiculous writing it, but you were kind to the cat and you shared a porch outlet." I thought maybe she shrugged. "I'm okay." That night I went to a volunteer training instead. Met my partner next to a table of free shovels. She nodded toward a person by the hose who waved with a familiarity that didn't need explanation. I asked if I could still help prune, still learn when to stop watering. "Of course," she said. "Plants forgive what people dramatize." We spent the rest of the morning in practical silence. When I left, Compostella shadowed me to the gate, tail like a question mark. I knelt to scratch behind her ears and thought about receipts. How they're proof of exchange, but not proof of courage. Story 19. On the red eye to our 10-year reunion, my seatmate told the flight attendant she'd take coffee, as if it owes me money. That made me laugh. We started talking in the kind of airplane logic where strangers trade secrets at 35,000 feet. Her name was Tessa. She worked in disaster mapping, drew hurricanes on napkins like spiral galaxies. We compared teachers, lunch specials, where to sit in the bleachers when you needed to cry. By Ohio, I was completely undone by the way she listened. I confessed, quietly, because it felt like sneezing in a museum, that I liked her. She rotated her napkin hurricane. "I had a crush on a guy senior year," she said, "and I did the brave thing. I left a note in his locker asking him to skip homeroom and watch the sunrise in the parking lot." She smiled, small. He wrote back, "Not my scene." I watched the sunrise alone. It was still good guilt hummed under my ribs in a key I hadn't heard since 17. I stared at the tray table like it would open and swallow me into cargo. "What was the locker number?" I asked, already knowing. She told me. "Mine." I apologized until it turned useless. Tessa tapped the napkin hurricane into a cyclone. "We were children," she said. Anyway, I told that version of me I'd keep trying sunrises. I did. Met someone during a dawn survey after a tornado. We were measuring tree fall, and he handed me a blueberry muffin like it was ceremony. We landed. In the rental car shuttle, reunion kids rehearsed triumphs. Tessa waved goodbye with two fingers against the glass. The campus was smaller than memory. The parking lot sunrise spot, ridiculously magical. I stood there empty-handed and imagined a note written in my adult handwriting. My scene is learning when to show up. I wrote it anyway and tucked it under a rock, a decade late. Useless and true. Story 20. I got my first tattoo the week my grandfather died. A lighthouse on my forearm, its beam slanting toward my elbow like a hand never quite reaching. The artist, Ash, worked with a gentleness that felt like consent in a language I barely spoke. Their studio smelled like green soap and citrus. The needle buzzed a low animal sound. We talked about grief and cheap candy and the way salt air ruins shoes. I left feeling steadier than the design. Months later, I booked another session, mostly because I wanted an excuse to see them. I rehearsed in the mirror. I like you. Not as a client. As a person who keeps light. When I said it, Ash set the machine down, eyes flicking to my tattoo like it might answer. I appreciate it, they said softly. But I need to tell you something so you don't think I'm being coy. They asked if I'd ever gone to Camp Selkie, the nerdy lake camp with composting toilets. I had, eighth grade, the summer I learned archery, and that mosquitoes like some people more out of spite. There was a kid who made you a woven bracelet, Ash said. Blue and white with a tiny shell woven in. They told you they liked you on the dock. You said, I'm not into camp romances, and you gave the bracelet back. It was the shell that did it. Memory flashed like a fish. A short-haired kid with a chipped tooth, the exact kind of bravery summer forces, hands shaking as they tied the knot around my wrist. I'd returned it like I was doing them a favor. That was me, Ash said. I cut my hair different now, different name, same shell. They pointed to a small frame on the shelf. Inside, that bracelet faded but stubborn. I kept it. Not to mope, to remind myself I'm allowed to ask. They smiled then, unexpected and wide. And I kept asking. Met my partner on a flash tattoo day when we both chose the same tiny fox for no good reason. We've been comparing scars happily ever since Ash wrapped my arm in plastic, hands careful as if covering wet paint. I'm glad you told me, they added. You deserve to tell the truth out loud. Walking home past shop windows, full of my reflection, the lighthouse beam looked brighter. Funny how light can travel years to reach you, and how by the time it does, the star that sent it has become something else entirely. Story 21, senior year. I captained the robotics team, worshipping deadlines and burnt fingertips. A week before prom, Kara, the only person who could coax a clean line from our temperamental CNC, rolled a cart into the shop. On it, an LED matrix spelling out PROM in scrolling text, timed between two stepper motors that swung paper flowers like a parade. Everyone clapped. I panicked, mumbled something about focus before regionals, and killed the power strip like I was defusing a bomb. The room dimmed, so did her face. We won regionals, and I told myself life had vindicated me. 8 years later, I went to a maker fair to feel that old hum again. Center stage, a talk on small satellites, the kind that carry other people's prayers through the ionosphere. The speaker's name hit me like a test light. Kara. She'd shed the hesitancy I remembered. Even her silence between slides felt engineered. After, I waited by a bin of scrap acrylic until the crowd thinned, then blurted out my confession, how I'd always liked her, how I'd been stupidly married to a project. She looked at my hands first, still calloused, and smiled without heat. I asked you once, she said. Every LED on that sign was a solder joint worth a tiny burn. She pointed to a man taping a crate shut with patient care. Elias and I met at a CubeSat launch. He stayed up 3 nights proving a fix wasn't luck, a universe of shared time compressed into those sentences. We helped coil extension cords. When she handed me a resistor that had fallen into the dust, I held it like a relic. Tiny, precise, designed to keep current from burning a path it shouldn't. Outside, the late light was coppery and undeserved. I realized prom had never been the point. The point was that she'd already built something for me once, and I'd pulled the plug. Story 22. In college, I hosted a midnight radio show, the kind listened to by insomniacs and people in love with ghosts. One January, a caller requested a song, and between the opening bars, confessed she liked the host with the bad puns and decent vinyl. I laughed it off on air, called it a flattering interference, then pivoted to weather like feelings were static. The switchboard glowed for a while. I played three long tracks in a row and pretended the studio hum was enough. Years later, podcasts killed my station, but not my habit of staying up late to listen. A friend dragged me to a live taping for a narrative show about cities at night. The producer took Q&A afterward. Sharp shoes, softer voice. When I thanked her for the episode and asked her out, it felt like opening a window in a quiet room. She tilted the mic away. "You ran graveyard shift on WQNR, right?" Her smile had the shape of a memory. "I called you once. I was 19 and idiotic enough to put my name out there." She described the set list from that night, then pulled up an ancient MP3 on her phone. There I was, younger and braver about everything except being kind, making a joke that let me keep moving. "I learned not to throw confessions into static," she said, not angry. Just edited. "I made shows instead." She nodded toward a woman by the soundboard rolling cable with a muscle memory that looked like partnership. After the taping, I walked past the old brick building where my station had lived. Windows black, antenna gone. I could almost hear the dead air I'd chosen rather than answer. Static is still a choice. It always was. Some people become transmitters anyway. Story 23. Freshman year, I volunteered at the hospital to pad my med school resume. I wheeled patients to imaging, fetched warm blankets like they were rare birds. A nursing student named Alma worked my shift, calm hands, hurricane eyes. One night in the employee stairwell, she said she liked me, and would I get coffee after clinicals? I gave a speech about focus and boundaries, trying to sound doctorly in scrubs two sizes too big. She nodded, folded the moment up like gauze, and moved on. A decade later, I was the one in triage with a soccer sprain and a pride bruise, holding my wrist like a bad excuse. The resident who palpated the swelling introduced herself as Dr. Alvarez Alma. The name stitched a seam in time so neatly I almost didn't feel it. She was different now, still kind, but the kindness wore steel underneath. I told her the truth while she wrapped my hand. That I'd liked her then and like her now, that I'd been a coward with borrowed words. Her eyes softened and did not change. "I asked you once," she said, taping the splint down with professional finality. It was a big deal to ask. She glanced toward the curtain, where laughter bubbled from another bay. "I met Raul during nights on pediatrics. We've been triaging each other's disasters ever since on discharge." She handed me exercises and a tiny loop of elastic band. "Do these," she said, "and stop ignoring pain because it's inconvenient." That goes for the other kind, too. Outside the ER, a med flight cut the sky in half. I sat on the curb with my packet, reading instructions written for bodies but fitting other injuries. Rest, elevate, don't pretend it didn't happen. Alma had been my first patient, I realized, and I'd charted her wrong. Story 24. At 19, I lived out of a backpack and a bad plan. In a Lisbon hostel, a woman named Sophia asked if I wanted to chase the last tram up to Graça and split a paper cone of sardines. She said it like an adventure and a kindness. I told her I didn't do vacation romances and went back to teaching myself guitar badly on the courtyard steps. She left a note tucked into my guidebook anyway. "If you change your mind, yellow scarf, 8 p.m. I did not change my mind. Someone else wore a yellow scarf. 10 years later, at a documentary festival, a short about neighborhood bakers gutted me. The camera loved flower dust the way memory loves light. The director came out for applause. Sophia. The yellow scarf was now a camera strap. We met by a table of pastel de nata, powdered sugar rising like confession smoke, and I told her everything I hadn't said then. She smiled as if at a street performer botching the trick, but leaving the joy intact. "I was brave for 5 minutes once," she said. You were principled for an hour. We both kept going. She glanced toward a woman adjusting a lens cap with the intimacy of someone who has packed 1,000 bags alongside yours. We swapped bakery recommendations, Rua do Arsenal to Alfama. She asked about my guitar. I admitted I'd sold it to pay for a flight and never bought another. You should, she said. Even if you only learn one good song, that night in my rental, the guidebook I kept for nostalgia fell open where the spine had always cracked. Something thin slid out, the old note, yellowed, stubborn. I finally went for sardines, alone, and ate them with my fingers by the river. The tram sighed uphill, as sure of its route as I'd pretended to be. Story 25. There's a chess cafe 2 blocks from my apartment that smells like espresso and concentration. I started going during a winter that refused to end. A woman with a buzz cut and a terrifying endgame ran the Saturday ladder. Her name tag said Ivy-TD. After losing to her 3 weeks straight, I asked if she'd like to grab dinner, stumbling on I like you, like it was a square I wasn't sure was safe. She rested her chin on her fist and studied me as if I were a position worth calculating. I made the first move once, she said. In high school, regional finals. I asked you to celebrate at the diner. You told me you don't date people who think 10 moves ahead. I remembered saying it with a smirk I thought looked charming. It had looked like a wall. Ivy slid a score sheet across the table, a copy of our last game. She'd annotated my blunders not to gloat but to teach. I met my partner at a midnight tournament, she said, quiet pride edging the words. We split a clock and a piece of pie. We still argue about whether pie is a tempo we played again. I lasted longer and still lost. On her final move, she underpromoted to a knight. Unnecessary. Elegant. A flourish that said the game had been decided 12 turns ago. In the diagram book I bought on the way out, there's a chapter on zugzwang. Positions where any move worsens things. Where your turn is the disadvantage. People talk about romance like attack and defense. But this felt truer, knowing when you had the move once and you passed. I page that chapter now and then, tracing the cramped glyphs with a pen, trying to see the earlier board. Trying to remember. She already sacrificed once. It wasn't mine to capture twice. Story 26. I work out of a co-working space where the calendar is just a mosaic of strangers' ambitions. Pitch nights, coding meetups, a pottery pop-up because somebody's VC secretly throws clay. The community manager, Lila, stitches it all together. She's the one who remembers dietary restrictions and which cables to jiggle when the projector decides it's an existentialist. After a month of crossing paths, her rolling out seltzer towers, me pretending my deadlines were heavier than they were, I realized I liked her. Not just the competence, the way she made chaos purr, but the jokes she dropped like confetti for anyone paying attention. I asked if she'd want to get dinner after the Thursday Founders panel. The room was between events, echoey with stackable chairs. Lila set a sign on the door, "Please do not move the plants," and turned back to me with a small smile that said she could both handle this and wished she didn't have to. "Can I show you something?" she asked, and pulled up an old dating app. My chest sank before I even saw the screen. Muscle memory recognized the color scheme. 2 summers ago, she said, I wrote you first. You said, and I quote, I'm in a heads-down season. No time for anyone who needs effort. Then you unmatched. I remembered sitting on my couch, swiping like a nervous habit. I remembered that line. Rehearsed because it sounded entrepreneurial instead of unkind. On her phone was my profile photo. Hair longer, arrogance the same. Lila slid the phone away like closing a cookbook. It took a lot for me to write first, she said. I learned I like people who make room even during their heads-down seasons. I met someone in this building who does. We share the front desk on Fridays through the glass. The receptionist grinned at a courier, stapler as baton. I apologized, suddenly aware that I was a recurring event she'd already archived. Lila's smile didn't sharpen. It landed soft. You're fine, she said. You're kind now. Keep being that way when it's busy. That night, the founders pitched moonshots. I kept thinking about plants and signs and how no time is just a story we tell when we're afraid of being seen. Story 27. Community theater taught me that tape marks on a stage are small promises. Stand here, say it true. 5 years ago, during callbacks for a chaotic production of Into the Woods, the assistant stage manager, June, offered me a ride home. In the car, she confessed she liked me, cheeks pink from sprinting mics and corralling singing bakers. I, in my 20-something certainty, said I didn't do theater romances. I made it sound principled. What I meant was I didn't want to be teased by the cast. June nodded, professional even in heartbreak, and we finished the run as colleagues. Last month, our city mounted a festival, and June came back as the director people whispered about, a fixer with a binder that could stop a bullet. I volunteered carpentry, then fell in love in slow motion. Her rehearsal notes that felt like love letters to truth, the way she caught mistakes without catching throats. Opening week, standing under work lights that made the dust look like snow, I told her I liked her, that I'd been a coward back when our world smelled like rosin and hairspray. June set her headset down, eyes steady. I asked you once, she said, after strike that night. I sat in my car 5 extra minutes so I wouldn't cry walking to my apartment. She glanced toward the catwalk where a woman in a black ball cap adjusted a shutter with practiced tenderness. Emma and I met hanging a CIC 2 seasons later. We finished screwing casters on a wagon that needed to glide like gossip. When we tested the movement, it rolled perfectly. No wobble. That's the trick, June said, squinting along the track. All the little alignments you can't see. I went home with paint on my knuckles and a new respect for tape marks. Some promises are tiny, some are loud. The loudest might be the one you declined to keep when somebody else already held the line for you. Story 28. I adopted my mutt Buster on a rainy Sunday when the shelter lobby smelled like bleach and yearning. A volunteer with freckles and a ponytail handed me the leash and a folder full of instructions, the last page clipped to a kennel card with a doodled paw print. I barely noticed the handwriting at the bottom. If you need help with training, text M. I told myself they probably wrote that on everyone's card and stuffed it in a drawer next to expired coupons and bravado. Buster turned into my better hobby. We learned sidewalks, then parks, then the logic of crows. Months later at the dog park, Buster beelined to a woman tossing a ball with the kind of wrist snap you only learn from repetition. It was her, the volunteer. Only now she wore a ball cap with the rescue logo and a confidence that made shy dogs sit just to be near it. We traded training tips, then stories. By the time the sun dropped behind the chain link, my confession was already alive in my mouth. I said it. I like you. She smiled, slow and warm like a dog deciding you're safe.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as 1 day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Liked you once, she said. I left my number on the kennel card. It took me 20 minutes to write those 2 sentences because I didn't want to overstep. When you didn't text, I taught myself not to take it personally. She nodded toward the far gate where a vet in muddy scrubs was crouched to greet a tripod pit bull. I met Danny doing midnight bottle feedings. We flirted over heating pads. Buster dropped the ball at my feet as if to say, "Play the game in front of you." I tossed it. The volunteer, Mara, whistled softly, and 3 nervous dogs came running like punctuation. On the walk home, I fished the folder from the drawer. The note was still there, edges softened by humidity. It hadn't been generic. The doodled paw looked like Buster's actual paw. I texted anyway. Thanks for the training tip on loose leash walks. Mara replied with a PDF and a smiley for Buster. Love can be a leash. It can also be a door you forgot you promised to open. Story 29. I learned to shoot film out of spite at my own impatience. The lab near my apartment sells rolls that smell like old libraries and hope. On Tuesdays, they run a beginner's darkroom class. The instructor, Rowena, wears a key on a string and speaks as if light is a fugitive you coax rather than catch. After three classes of trays and tongs and negatives that look like ghost stories, I realized I liked her. I said so while we waited for a batch to wash, voice low, like the chemicals would be offended. Rowena held my gaze, then reached into a metal drawer and pulled out a contact sheet. Do you recognize this place? It was a footbridge in winter, the river under it scored with ice. 5 years ago, she said, I messaged you on a photography forum and asked if you wanted to join a photo walk here. You wrote, I don't collab with strangers off the internet. Too many weirdos. I went alone. I made this. The contact sheet was beautiful and lonely. I remembered my message, the way I'd dressed fear as discernment. I didn't mean, I started and stopped. I had meant it then. Rowena slid the sheet back, kind. It's okay, she said. I met someone on a different walk. We shoot the same camera by accident and now share film like groceries. She nodded toward a woman at the enlarger, laughing silently at an inside joke with the safe light. We finished the wash cycle. She handed me my negatives like a fragile timeline. You're getting better, she said. Focus earlier. Commit to your exposure. At home, I pinned the bridge contact print above my desk, a reminder that the world doesn't wait for your courage. You choose your aperture. You live with the light you let in. Sometimes the shot is there, and sometimes you're the one who isn't.